Okay, let me officially welcome everyone to today's Conversations with the Masters call with my guest, Robert Augustus Masters. My name is Mary Allen, as many of you know, and I am a Master Certified Coach, author of The Power of Inner Choice, and, of course, your host of this Conversations with the Masters series. Before I introduce Robert, I want to just welcome all of our live listeners on the main line and those in the webcast, and those of you who may be listening to this as a recording. I so appreciate you continuing to spread the word about these calls. Really makes a difference in getting this information into the ears and hearts and minds of more people. Today's call is being recorded, so you can go back and listen again or refer a friend to listen. And if you've pre-registered for the call, you'll be receiving a special follow-up email probably by the end of this week. No guarantees. I want to invite you to clear all distractions. You may pull out a notepad, but really allow yourself to take in today's call fully. There may be some things that maybe confronting, yet I promise that if you're willing to explore with an open mind and an open heart, this call and Robert's book, Spiritual Bypassing, may be a life changer for you. And I have to say, I've just been so looking forward to this call. It's been a while since I couldn't put a book down, and I really believe in just every cell of my being that this is one of the most important reads for anyone that's on a spiritual path. It will challenge your edges, but it's ultimately about deepening your spiritual connection and thus experiencing a greater sense of genuine inner peace, not just a state of inner peace. And, of course, before I even got to the end of the book, like within the first chapter, I'm like, oh, I've got to have Robert on as a guest for Conversations with the Masters. So, Robert, I'm really delighted that you're here. And for those of you that don't know Robert, I want to just offer a little bit of formal introduction. Robert Augustus Masters is a PhD and is the author of 11 books, including Spiritual Bypassing and Darkness Shining Wild. He holds a doctorate in psychology and is a highly experienced psychotherapist, trainer of psychotherapists, and teacher of spiritual deepening. His integral intuitive work has been developed over the past 33 years and dynamically blends the psychological and physical with the spiritual, emphasizing embodiment, authenticity, deep shadow work, emotional openness and literacy, and the development of relational maturity. Those who work with him are taught, among other things, how to turn toward and enter their pain so that they might pass through it rather than rising above and otherwise avoiding it. At essence, his work is about becoming more intimate with all that we are, dark and light, high and low, shallow and deep, neurotic and transcendent, dying and undying. And he and his wife, Diane, work and teach closely together, and they do all their group sessions and trainings together, and hopefully we'll get him to share a little bit about some of those towards the end of our call. So welcome, Robert.
Oh, thank you, Mary.
So great to have you here. And, well, let's jump right into this, your book, Spiritual Bypassing. Maybe you could just start, for those that didn't read the article that we accompanied some of the promotional material with, you know, really to explain in layman's term, what is this whole concept of spiritual bypassing?
Well, spiritual bypassing basically means using spiritual practices, spiritual beliefs, to avoid dealing with unresolved wounds, emotional pain, developmental tasks. It's an avoidance, and I was brought to this through my work with many, many people who are on spiritual paths, who I saw suffering primarily because they were expecting their spiritual practices to liberate them without having done the necessary psychological and emotional work. So they were constantly trying to deal with old emotional issues through spiritual practice alone. And in that they were bypassing much of their humanity, making an enemy, for example, out of anger, labeling certain emotions negative and trying to stay away from them even though they kept arising. So I saw so much of this over the years that finally I wanted to write a book about it, and I was surprised no one had ever written a book about it. The term's been around for a while, but there's been no book on it as of yet. So I just dove right in, and I'm really glad I did.
I'm really glad you did too, because there's been sort of a, you know, you see these certain practices, and I've got a good friend that has even come out and said, no, it's like, I really believe you don't have to go into the pain, that you can really just focus on joy and shift your mind. And it's like, intuitively, it's like, it sure hasn't been my experience.
I've never seen it work for anyone. In fact, those who say that are usually in the most pain of all. They've learned to dissociate more skillfully, we could say, than anyone else. Because it's so easy to dissociate from pain and think that we're done with it and rise above it. Then we make too much of a virtue out of being positive. We get stuck in positive thinking and trying to be positive, and in that we neglect so much of our humanity that we might label dark or negative, which isn't really truly dark and negative. It's just simply been neglected, kept in the shadows. Mm-hmm. So when we start to cut through spiritual bypassing, we start to embrace aspects of ourselves that we had previously rejected or ostracized.
Well, and so who is caught up in spiritual bypassing? Is it just people doing spiritual practices? Is it across the board?
It's across the board. I mean, if we really look at it deeply, everyone that's on a spiritual path either is doing some spiritual bypassing or has done it, myself included. Wherever you see spirituality, you see spiritual bypassing. That's why I see a huge amount of it in places like Boulder and Ashland, California, Hawaii, places where there's more overt spiritual practice going on. It's such a temptation when one is in pain, does some meditation, some chanting, some spiritual practice, and starts to feel better because of that. Then we get overly attached to those practices because they initially felt pretty good. We have kind of a prolonged honeymoon with them, while our less than seemingly spiritual qualities are knocking at the door saying, hey, pay attention to me too. I'm here. I'm part of you. Here's our full humanity calling to us. And here we are saying, this is good. I want you, but I don't want you. And when we turn away from an aspect of ourselves, it inevitably festers, multiplies, and encodes this outcast will throughout the rest of us.
Well, as we get into some of the more common practices of spiritual bypassing, I imagine that certainly as I read your book, there's certainly, almost every one I could find in some way that, I get caught up in this from time to time. So probably goes for everybody here on this call. But I'm wondering, we can either, as we're listening here today, we can either step into more denial and say, oh, well, I don't do that one. Or we could go to a place of really beating ourselves up, neither of which seems like a very good idea. So do you maybe have a suggestion or guidance for our listeners?
As you said that, the word shame kept popping into my mind. I see shame as the most neglected emotion, not only in psychotherapy, but also in spiritual practice. It's that the shame that kind of gets us to want to turn our back on things that aren't so pleasant in life, and we want to get away from it. We don't want to admit that we perhaps get more reactive with our partner than we let our friends know, or that we have certain skeletons in the closet, or that we just keep falling short. There's a sense of, and that's unhealthy shame. We beat ourselves up for our transgressions, whereas there's a healthy shame, which in a sense could be called the herald of conscience. Without shame, we wouldn't really have conscience. And part of the answer to what you were asking earlier is to become more intimate with our shame, to get to know it really well, to notice, what do we do when we feel shame? Do we let it mutate into aggression, whether other-directed or inner-directed? Do we withdraw, dissociate? Do we let it turn into guilt? Or do we just stay with it, feel it to the core, feel the remorse, say we're sorry, make amends, do whatever is necessary, and get back on track instead of just staying off the sidelines, beating ourselves, or rising above the whole thing and acting like there's nothing wrong going on. So it's so crucial to get really, really intimate with our shame. And of course, once you're doing that, you have to also become intimate with your anger, your fear, all the different states that perhaps we've spent a lot of time trying to get away from or medicating away, or meditating away.
Medicating and meditating.
Yeah.
Meditation can be a form of medication, right?
Exactly. Or people in retreats often say, well, I'm just sitting with my anger. And I often say, you know what? consider the possibility that you're not just sitting with it, you're sitting on it.
Mm.
And it's so easy to kind of press these things down, push them in the dark, in a dark corner of our psyche, as if to say, that's not me, that's not me, I'm not like that. And then in our private lives, it emerges, and what pain for someone to act as if they have, for example, gone beyond anger in their private life, they're acting it out like crazy.
Mm.
So a lot of what I'm writing about is a call to say, how about embracing our humanity discerningly and deeply, not turning away from any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then one spiritual practice tends to deepen because there's just more of you there. Instead of trying to transcend it all, I mean, when I was in my 30s, I wanted to transcend it all. I was extremely ambitious spiritually, and I found out the hard way that the things I didn't really like about myself weren't going to go away just because I meditated deeply, did some therapy. They were there, and my job, as I came to see it, was not to get rid of these qualities, but to become intimate with them, to befriend them.
Mm-hmm.
And when they arise in a relationship and work, I can see them, I can name them, and I can kind of make room for them. It's like having a somewhat unpleasant guest in one's home, and just being kind towards that being, that guest. And then there's a discharge, you know. So this is about being loving towards all that we are, but it's not a soft, weak-kneed, spineless love. It's a love that can be fierce as it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
I often say to people, anger, healthy anger and love can coexist.
Well,
and there is such a thing as fierce compassion. We can be compassionate with someone, truly compassionate, and be fierce because our quiet approach may not be working under certain conditions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is good. So if we approach kind of all the common practices of spiritual bypassing, and really get curious and kind of be with and not in a beat yourself up kind of way, but in a
exactly
in a just being with it. So,
mm-hmm.
Great, I love that as a just.
I think it's a further step, Mary, on the path to awakening is to shift from just wanting to transcend whatever's there to becoming intimate with it.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually that intimacy will lead to a true transcendence. But the intimacy, it makes it completely obvious the fact that we are in relationship all the time.
Mm-hmm.
With everyone, everything. Everything exists through relationship. Nothing exists unto itself without any connection with anything else. So to me, relationship is such a core reality of life. And intimacy is kind of the poetry of relationship. It's what it can be. And to become intimate with a quality in oneself that we tend to pull away from, like fear, for example, it's amazing what riches are in fear. I often say to people in groups, you know, in a simplistic way of speaking perhaps, fear is basically just excitement and drag.
Mm.
It's like, fear is like a fist, contraction, tight, it's unpleasant. The hand opens, the fist unfurls, and suddenly, same adrenaline, same energy, but now it's excitement, it's passion. But if you try and push away the fear initially, you won't be able to. It won't be transmuted into excitement or anger or whatever. You'll tend to just float, somewhat disembodied above it. And it's a big step when we decide at a certain point in our growth work to stop running from our fear, stop making it wrong, and turn toward it. And invariably what we tend to find, among other things in that journey, is a younger us, a fearful us, that we tend to not want to be around. We're kind of embarrassed by this part of ourselves that gets scared easily, frightened. And then we shift from pushing it away to embracing it, like a good parent, bringing that part of yourself into your heart. So it's almost like you're not turning away from that fearful child in yourself or that fearful teen or whatever it is. You're making room in your being for
mm-hmm.
that one. And then you become more whole. There's more of Robert. There's more of Mary. There's more of us when we do that.
Mm-hmm. So fear arises, and we may just say, oh, hello, fear.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what you have to say here.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, that's beautiful. We sit down and we listen, like you were just suggesting. We actually listen with our whole being. And we actually can hear. There's a message from it. It may not be primarily verbal, but there is a message when we listen. And we can't hear it if we're running in the opposite direction.
Right, and we're in resistance and we're pushing it away and saying, fear is bad and I just need to I need to hire somebody to help me transcend this and get rid of it.
If I'm really spiritual, I shouldn't have any fear. Oh, my God, I've got fear. Oh, my God, I'm a failure. Then shame kicks in.
Right, and I can't let
anyone know. Everyone's got fear. The Dalai Lama has admitted that he gets quite anxious at times. Thank God he's said that.
Wow, yeah.
So it's like, you know...
Well, since we're on kind of the uncomfortable emotions, let's talk about anger, because I know that's a big one that, especially in spiritual communities, not so spiritual, they get all angry and have a temper and let it go. And like, what does being intimate with anger look like in a healthy way?
It starts off by learning the difference between healthy and unhealthy anger. You know, the difference between anger and aggression, for example. Like, where if I'm angry at you and it's clean, I'm not shaming you. I'm not blaming you. But I'm also not pussyfooting around. I may be quite intense, but you can feel in it. I'm still with you. I'm caring for you. I'm not out to attack you. Once I shift into attacking you, trying to put you down, getting very clever with my language, rolling my eyes, sarcasm creeps in, etc. That's not clean. I'm out to get you. It sounds like anger. It looks like anger, but the context is aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
It's out to attack. It's not vulnerable. See, real anger. If you're really angry at me, for example, you could be very loud, but you'd be very close to tears, and vice versa, because anger, pure healthy anger, is very vulnerable.
Mm.
And often it's the guardian of our boundaries. It can flame through a lot of deadwood in relationship, but many of us have not learned how to use anger skillfully. So we either act it out, giving released anger a bad name, or we repress it.
Mm-hmm.
And both are implicated in disease. Repressed anger is, you know, implicated in a lot of disease. So is overly expressed anger. So there's an art to it. And you can't exercise that art if you're not intimate with it. And being intimate with it means you get to know it really well. When you're angry, what happens to your jaw, the small of your back? How old do you feel? How was anger dealt with when you were a child? What happens when you're angry at your partner? I mean, it's worth exploring it, and the spirit of this is the spirit of curiosity and investigation. Rather than saying, oh, it's bad, it's negative. Like, for example, a lot of Buddhism, anger is equated in their root texts with ill will and hatred. So it gets translated often as that, like anger equals hatred or ill will. It can go in that direction, but doesn't have to.
What matters
is what do we do with our anger?
Right. So can you give an example of anger expressed in a healthy manner, and then contrast that with a not so healthy, or let's say a spiritual bypassing manner? Because I imagine some people may then begin to learn this and learn what it looks like on the exterior to do clean anger, thinking they're doing clean anger.
Well, let's say, for example, the example came to me right away. Say if your partner is really being reactive.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear he's being reactive. And you're angry that he's doing this. He's done it many times before. He's not admitting it. And this happens frequently in couples.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're clean, you may just say to him, you know, stop. There's an agreement. You may say, stop, or no, I don't like what you're doing. There's no shame or put down. You're just interrupting his ritual, inviting him to wake up in the midst of the bad dream he's having, the reactive dream. If you weren't clean in it, you might say, oh, here you go again. You roll your eyes. You put him down. You shame him. Then he gets even angrier and feels more justified in his reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
So in the former case, you're just simply saying, here's where I am, but I'm not going to sit back and nicely take this because you're off and this is hurting me. And when I say stop, I mean stop.
Excuse me.
It's a neutral term.
Mm-hmm.
Spiritual bypasser, what would they do? They would, if they're in the extremes of spiritual bypassing, would make you wrong if you were the one showing some anger, proclaiming in a certain way that you lost touch with your spirituality. They'd shame you for going there. Or they might be blindly compassionate and be so nice and sweet to you. You could be completely off and be treating them horribly, and they still would smile at you and try and make nice, like an abused child would do with a parent that's abusing them, to keep the peace.
Right. So they're internally saying something like, this is fine, you know, he's just being angry, and I'm good with it. But, well, and this is...
And they would also say, Mary, sorry to interrupt, and they would also say things like, what's to say about me? And they turn all the heat back on them. What's to say about me that I'm upset that my partner is flirting outrageously with another woman? What's to say about me? And they forget to put the heat on him and to look at the relationship, the intersubjective space between the two partners.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a form of spiritual bypassing too, where we just don't engage deeply. And we also, here's the primal part of it, we have not learned to say no
mm-hmm.
in a way that's authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And if I say no to you with a big smile on my face, you're going to get a mixed message. If I just say no directly and firmly, no nasty edge to it, it's very clear where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us don't feel like we should just be saying yes, yes, yes. And yet, how can you say a full-blooded, authentic yes if you can't do the same with a no?
Mm-hmm.
If you can't say a full no, then your yes becomes anemic. It becomes somewhat suspect. Maybe you're just doing it to keep the peace. You're giving the other person, you're cutting them too much slack so they won't be upset with you,
mm-hmm.
et cetera.
Mm. Boy, I can see we can take any, you know, any concept and you go in and there's like, you know, I'm seeing, of course, because I read the book, all the different facets of spiritual bypassing that can pop up, and just a conversation about getting to clean anger. You know,
just that. So we could spend an hour on that, and it'd be quite fruitful. And part of that's because I'm working with Diane, my partner and wife, in the trenches,
mm-hmm.
doing deep psychotherapy, which involves some spiritual practice, but it's mostly just working with wounding, healing, and it's hard work. And I see so much of what goes on. So when I talk about anger, so I've seen this thousands of times, or any emotion. You know, we teach emotional literacy. We're not just doing talk therapy. So we're right in there. So I see it all the time. So I feel very at home speaking about it. And you're right. We could take one area. I'd like to cover other areas, obviously.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I want to see if we can, well, hit as much as we can. It's like,
yeah.
I always get very ambitious about what we can cover in a call, but we'll try and touch upon everything.
Yeah.
So, okay. So let's circle to, you know, some of the common practices of spiritual bypassing. We've kind of looked at one big set, which is not being intimate with, especially the not so positive emotions. And we've kind of touched upon a couple, but maybe just to kind of bullet out some of the common practices of spiritual bypassing, and then we'll dive into as many of them as we can.
Wow, so many.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they all come under the umbrella of avoiding pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a simple way of looking at avoiding pain, but there's blind compassion. There's anger phobia. I don't have a list in front of me. I'm just thinking, what else? Is using sexuality in a way that to make ourselves feel better and to kind of discharge the tension from other from unresolved issues we have, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
You could take almost any area and see here's how it can be bypassed, including spiritually. There's also a lot of intellectual bypassing. We see that frequently in our session work with people, among the men more than the women, but the women too. A lot of bypassing through simply getting very intellectual. So it's all tied in with avoiding pain. Poor boundaries, that's another sign of spiritual bypassing, or even an associate of being under-boundaried with somehow being spiritual. Like, oh, I'm really open. I'm open to it all. It's not a true openness. It's undiscerning.
Mm-hmm.
Like opening the gates to everything and everyone is not necessarily a sane practice.
Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have to say no to certain things. You
mm-hmm.
just have to have that capacity.
Mm-hmm. This is good. Well, and how about, I know one of the other, I guess, signs of spiritual bypassing can be taking certain concepts like the concept of oneness or some of the kind of key phrases saying, oh, it's all an illusion or it's all good.
Yes, exactly.
Whatever bothers you isn't really, you know, it's not really about you.
Exactly.
So maybe speak a little bit to that one.
Yeah, they're very prevalent and they all can be cut through.
Well, and how is, you know, we take a concept of oneness, which seems like kind of a good idea, you know, that we're, you know, and maybe on the very deepest level, it's we are all one. How can that disconnect us from?
It's because we get over-focused on the inherent oneness we all share, the inherent unity of being, which is a no-brainer once you've gone and done deep work, spiritual practice, you just know it. But to me, that's not the end of human awakening and spiritual practice. Is the very, very beginning to get that that's true. And at the same time, the interesting question is not just okay, we're all one, but the question then arises, how are we different? We differ.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the dance. We're human beings, so there's all these differences we have, all the issues around relationship. Because if you just go to straight oneness, to non-dual state, you can bypass relationship. And there's a time and a place for that, but it can easily be overdone. And I often say, you know, rather than seeking union with something, seek intimacy with it. Because if I'm at one with something, I may be fused with it and have no space to consider it clearly. If I'm intimate with something, I'm extremely close to it, or to the, if it's with a person, to that person. But at the same time, I have just enough distance from them so I can keep my focus clear. Like, to me, real intimacy is a dance of profoundly deep connection and a healthy separation. So that autonomy is not overridden in the name of being close.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people get caught up in the notion of oneness, are, in a sense, pushing away relatedness. So they're not really at one. There's a division. Like, just like they may also divide emotions into positive and negative, and do things like that that create more division. Like, an authentic oneness does not create division. It coexists with the duality we live in. They work together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what else is dangerous here, too, is the notions that, you know, we create it all, blah, blah, blah. This New Age notion of creating one's reality.
Oh, yeah, there's another big one.
Power, and then someone gets ill. Oh, what'd you get? Why, you created cancer for yourself? What are you getting out of that? As if somehow that person is doing that. And there are other factors that they have no control over and are not really there. And many people who believe this feel so guilty, so horribly guilty, when they get really sick and they cannot heal it through their affirmations and their different health practices. They feel like they failed,
mm-hmm.
forgetting that great beings like Ramana Maharshi died of cancer. It's like this, we're going to die, and we may not die in a very pleasant way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily a sign of spiritual slippage.
So you probably had a few people really confront you on the, no, really, we create it all. We create it all. Isn't that true, Robert?
I have that occasionally, but it's pretty easy to bust through because there's so many signs of where one cannot do that. We can think it as a theory, a theoretical possibility that it could happen, but I'm thinking of a Jim Carrey movie where he is very, very drawn to this woman, and she clearly wants nothing to do with him. He says, what are the chances of us getting together? She says, one in a million. He goes, all right, fantastic. It's one in a million. Wow, as if that now means it could happen. Yes, it could, but in realistic terms, we know it's not going to. And a lot of magical thinking among spiritual bypass just has the same quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a sense of egocentricity in it. Like, if the bus is late, we may go, well, what's this say about me? What does this mean? Everything happens for a reason. And we're not noticing that we're having it all revolve around us. Maybe the bus is just late. Maybe there's other factors at play.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a confusion in that of mistaking correlation and causation, thinking just because two sets of data have a positive correlation, that means that one causes the other. That's magical thinking. So that's the more gross form of spiritual bypassing. We see it in New Age communities, but there are more subtle forms, and say among people that are much sharper, more developed cognitively, who've done a lot of meditation, they may still be subtly averting themselves from their humanity.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and they may be using non-dual pronouncements, like it's all an illusion, da-da-da-da-da, and they're... It's such a tricky territory because people can use that proclamation to keep themselves immune to their suffering and the suffering of others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and how does that affect our ability to deal with issues that are going on in the real world? You know, the economy,
exactly.
Lots of people losing their homes, really struggling. How is it actually useful or maybe detrimental that we're saying it's all
good? What it does, Mary. It allows us to dissociate from that. Spiritualize the dissociation, and we don't notice that we're choosing numbness.
Mm-hmm.
If you really feel what's going on in the world now, it breaks the heart. And I think hearts need to be broken. People need to feel it. They can't just popcorn themselves through the news. There's a sense of, this is stuff's going on, and I'm not just going to wail and around it and think horrible thoughts, I'm going to feel it. I'm going to open my heart to this, because once my heart's open to it, then, especially if I have some belly and I'm grounded, I can maybe make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But if I don't feel what's going on, it won't work. Just like if you're in an argument with a close friend and you're not open to what they're feeling, you're not going to get very far if you don't open yourself to their reality. You may not agree with what they're saying, but if you emotionally connect with their world, there's an empathy. The often will flow back and forth. And once you have that empathetic connection, then you can agree and disagree. It doesn't matter as much.
Right. And we can move forward and co-create something out of this moment as opposed to just staying stuck in that place of resistance.
You're so right.
Mm-hmm.
You're so right. Yeah.
Yep.
And that means we're going back to where we were earlier, becoming more emotionally literate. So when there's a conflict with another person, we deal with the emotional dimensions of it. Most people try and deal with it just through arguing and being clever, and one person ends up usually being, you know, losing the argument, or it's a stalemate, but it doesn't bring about more closeness. Whereas if you connect emotionally, we do this with couples all the time when I work with couples, have them connect emotionally, spiritually too sometimes, to where there's a sense of here's a field of mutuality. And now, let's look at what happened yesterday. Let's look at what happened, your disagreement around how your kids are or what's going on with you sexually. Now we can look at that because you're connected.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how might you suggest for somebody that is wanting to really get more intimate with their emotions, yet is with a partner who isn't on a similar shared path of spirituality, and so is, you know, what is the one that actually wants to work with it? How do you dance in the face of somebody that is not as conscious and participating in the same way?
I think it's a very delicate dance, because at a certain, you don't want to rush them into it. At the same time, you don't want to sit back and just let it be, because then you have to compromise yourself to be with them. For example, if you're much more expressive than the other person, and you want to stay with that person, then you have to kind of mute your expressiveness so they don't get overwhelmed. And that may be fine initially, but after a while, you have to lay it on the line. We see this in couples all the time. You have to lay it on the line, and if the other person is not willing to go there, you may even be looking at a separation.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is capable of developing emotional literacy.
Well, that's
even
good
the
news.
Most, even the men who claim to have no capacity, I've seen them again and again and again. When they go for it, they can open. And then there's a lot of tears, and usually the top layer is shame.
Mm.
Once they've cut through their shame and seen it for what it is, then the tears come, then the anger, and then they're vulnerable. And then when their partner sees them like that, this connection is so quick. It's a mutual vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what is needed so sorely in relationship work, is that capacity to be vulnerable with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that means the heart's open. The more open my heart is, the more hurt I can get. Well, I'd rather have a really open heart and get hurt than have a partially open heart and not get so involved in life.
So for our men on the line who, and I'll even ask this question for my husband, because this is what he would be saying is, well, as a man, you know, there's part of what attracts a woman is being in the masculine, being strong. The whole wussy boy thing isn't really ultimately what women want.
He's wrong, because I'll say what I'd say to him is that what I've seen again and again and again, women don't necessarily want a quote-unquote wussy boy, but they want a man who's vulnerable and who has the strength to get vulnerable. It takes strength to excuse me, let down the guard and become vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, there's a healthy masculine, which is inherently vulnerable. It can weep. It can rage. It's vital. It's not uptight. It's not like a walking erection, to be kind of blunt. There's a fluidity. There's an ease.
Mm-hmm.
And that type of man, excuse me, is intimate with his boy, you know, his softness, his tenderness, but he's not spineless. Here's the mix. He's got balls, he's got spine, he's got heart, and he has the guts to be transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if a man wants an adventure that really has a lot of risk, it's kind of scary. That's the one, is go into your, get vulnerable without collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
Like sit tall in it, walk tall in it, but be vulnerable.
I like that, vulnerability without collapsing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And also finding a source of strength in your vulnerability. In other words, redefining what it is to be strong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I do all our couples work, and I see a man who's, you know, kind of a strong guy, kind of rigid, and he's not vulnerable. Whatever, it kind of wrecks things between him and his partner because she is not being met. She may put up with it, but she's not being met, and she's there's a lack of intimacy. And once a man like opens like that in therapy, I see the woman he's with almost always opens immediately. As soon as there's that sense of vulnerability, now we're connected.
Mm.
The other thing that fits along with this, excuse me, is how many men use sex to create connection.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've been teaching them for many long time has worked again and again and again. I say, you got it backwards. Create connection first. Women usually get this more quickly. Create connection first, maintain connection, then sex will be a natural byproduct or flowering of that connection. In other words, you're not burdening poor old sex with the obligation to make you feel better, make you feel more connected. Sex is then an expression of already present connection. And to have that connection, we go back to square one, you have to have some shared empathy, emotional literacy, transparency. And then the whole relationship becomes foreplay. I don't mean in a sexual sense. It just becomes foreplay because every conversation, every little bit of business done together is part of the connection. When that connection gets strong like that and stays consistently strong, sexuality flows very naturally. No need for tantric rituals or anything. It just flows organically forth because both people are connected.
Mm. Sounds really juicy. Sign me up some more of that. Well, and I know that's one of the spiritual bypassing things is either, you know, sex as an obligation to avoid confronting that, hey, you know, the connection and intimacy I want isn't here, but I want to keep my relationship. I don't want to get caught in losing that. So that can be, and that's another spiritual bypassing.
You know what's implicit in this, Mary, is the need for healthy challenge in a relationship.
Mm.
And we all have relationships, not just those of us who are in couple bonds. There's a need to really be able to challenge each other and have it be welcomed, even if it's a little prickly at times. It will be prickly sometimes. It is difficult. But that challenge means if you see your partner in a reactive space, you don't just let it be. You are loving enough with that person to give them the gift of your insight. You're not pushing. You're not trying to be the therapist. You're just simply saying, here's what I see. Here's what I feel. And if they know themselves, they'll realize they have regressed. They are being reactive. It takes enormous courage to say in the midst of reactivity, I am being reactive.
Mm.
You're blowing like I could say, I'm being defensive. Once we blow the whistle on ourselves, it deepens intimacy so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a lot of strength.
And it makes it more difficult to stay in defensive and reactive once we've even acknowledged it.
I know, because then once you say that, the heart's open a little bit, and there's a sense, oh, my God, how could I be speaking to him or her like that? I love him so much. And then the love comes back in, and it's a very grounded love. It maybe has some tears in it, but it's so connected. Out of that love, then you can take the dynamic further that's arisen between you,
mm-hmm.
however difficult it might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just having that courage to acknowledge when we're in reactivity, when we're in an emotionally stuck place, or I like to say, call it, you know, when we're in emotional turmoil of some sort, just acknowledging it can be one of that first step.
You know, it sounds so simple, but often the first step is to name it, to simply say, I'm angry right now. I feel angry at you. Or, God, I feel some shame when you said that. Instead of me lashing out at the other for daring to say that, you know, something that makes me feel shame, I could just say, I felt shame when you said that. We start with that, so I'm not putting them down. And it sounds easy. It's hard to do when you're in a reactive space, because at that point you're tempted. You want to, you know, the other person is wrong, and you're going to make sure they know it, or how dare they speak to you that way. We get in that state. Sometimes what Diane and I do, we will exaggerate our reactivity when one of us gets like that, to where it becomes absurd. Then there's laughter, and it's a real laughter. There's a breakthrough. It becomes hilarious to see here is the drama is being acted out, made into a melodrama. It doesn't last very long.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
which
so,
is much more.
And so who's starting the exaggerating the reactivity? Is it the one that's really caught in it, or is it the partner that is being the mirror?
The one being the mirror usually will if there's enough trust between the one being the mirror, can say, why don't you say that even more loudly? Why don't you wave your finger at me even more fiercely?
Beautiful.
Why don't you jump up? I mean, and there's no shame. It's not. There's no shame in it. It's like an encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important that the one who's being the mirror is not subtly putting the other one down for being reactive. Because we all get reactive, and the key is not to shame ourselves for it. The key is to wake up. It's like having a bad dream or nightmare, and it seems completely real. And I think we've all had the experience of some degree of lucidity in our dreams. We realize, I'm dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
This is a dream. Once you get that it's a dream, not a nightmare, most people want to leave right away, but I think it's very interesting to stay. Once you know it's a dream, you can stay in it, in the nightmare, in the reactivity, and you can see how it works.
Mm.
You can sense, and you can sense yourself at different ages. It goes on and on.
Mm. Oh, I love that. And I really love that you pointed to that there's no shame, because there have been times I'll cop to it that when my husband gets in a totally upset place about not being able to find a parking spot, I have kind of jumped in and like, I know, it's just so awful and the end of the world. And there have been ways that he's, you know, of course, later, you know, a year later or so, he communicates, I don't like it when you do that, because then he feels bad. In having this conversation in this context really creates the space for us to play with this, so he doesn't have to be in suffering over not finding a parking spot or whatever is stirring, you know, the emotion of the moment.
Yeah. And the thing is, when I see people that are on spiritual paths that say, how can I take this deeper, and they're solitary, I'll say, get in a relationship, because everything neurotic in you will be brought to the surface. You'll hate it sometimes, but when it's brought to the surface, then you can work with it. If it's not at the surface, you won't work with it. You'll think it's not there, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, intimate relationship, to me, is the ashram of the 21st century. It's, to me, intimate relationship can be a profound spiritual practice. I know it's my main spiritual practice, and I've done tons of other systems practices. Being with Diane, it's lovely, it's easy, we're extremely close, and it challenges me consistently to heal old wounds, to step into who I am more, and nothing else could do it like that for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I'm in so close, there's no escape. I have no plan B. So this is it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in that, I'm basically finding myself in a crucible and a sanctuary at the same time. It's a crucible because everything's been brought up that needs to be brought up. And it's a sanctuary. It's a safe place. It's safety.
Mm-hmm.
And it's grounded.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing about spiritual bypassing is that it is, one side is not grounded. If I'm a spiritual bypasser, I may be doing some flaky New Age stuff, or I could be just doing excessive amounts of Vipassana meditation, but not really grounded in my humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I've escaped it, either grossly or subtly, but I've escaped it. And in a good relationship, there's no escape, because if we're with the right partner, we don't get away with anything.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't mean we're fighting all the time. It just means just that sense of ease. Oh, I can just be me, and I can even share the most difficult stuff, and here it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And I've often said to people, I call that the highest part of that mature monogamy or being-centered relationship. I said to people, the journey toward that, even if it doesn't lead to a partner, a true partner for you, the journey itself is worth taking totally.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, whatever it takes to be ready for a really good partner, if you're single, is worth doing. It means facing one's conditioning, et cetera, et cetera. It means doing the work that you might not have done otherwise because it's so difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know it's one of the things you refer to in the book as an example of a spiritual shortcut is avoiding intimate partnership.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, maybe, well, all the reasons you named, it's like, I'm not, you know, not ready, not ready, not ready, but it also avoids dealing with kind of where the juiciest, deepest work can actually take place.
Yeah, because in part, in a really, truly intimate relationship, one thing that inevitably surfaces are old wounds, like, you know, things that happened when we were children. They don't have to be that dramatic or even abusive. They just surface, and they're there. And suddenly we're with our partner using adult language, and we're actually a hurt child. Once we know each other's history really well, we can see that's going on with our partner, see it in ourselves, and we can cut through it. Otherwise, we will have an argument that's based on a wounded child kind of seizing the helm. And what we often teach people is to take that place in themselves as wounded, hold it close like your loving, protective parent, but don't let it run the show. Don't let it drive the car.
Mm.
The kid, let it play in the back seat while you drive.
Mm.
There's a sense of fierce protectiveness in that, of standing up for oneself.
I just love the metaphors. You've got so many ways to take such really abstract concepts of spiritual bypassing and making them concrete and tangible and in a way that people can really get. I just so admire that about you. Well, there's like three more big topics I want to try and squeeze in here.
Sure.
So one of your chapters is called From Disembodied Spirituality to Embodied Being. And, you know, we look at what it's really costing us to ignore being with our body. And mm-hmm. I'll just say that I actually read this actually at the gym on the exercise bike. And right after that, got on a weight machine and pulled out my iPhone and checked email to find out that one of the members of my community, a former client, had just passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And here I just read your chapter about how we disembody from our bodies.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, be in your body, and be with
exactly.
you. You know, I was like so challenged, and I could just see that dance back and forth. No, I don't want to. Let me go back up to my head.
Maybe
speak to a little bit about this relationship about being in body and...
I think it's so important, it's so important not to leave our body out of any consideration of what it is to be fully human. Like, so much psychotherapy, for example, still does not include the body. And I've been working, doing body work in conjunction with psychotherapy for over 30 years. Well, I'm doing body work with someone while I'm doing psychotherapy at the very same second. I find it very effective. It's very intuitive. And I do it because it's effective, it's efficient. And when someone's embodied, they just have, life is so much easier. It sounds almost like a cliche, but you're just present. You feel your feet, you feel your legs, you feel the whole body. You're not just a head that's being carried around by a body. And the body then becomes not an it, it becomes me. Even though I know I'm more than my body, the body is a very eloquent expression of who I am and what I am. And I think we need to include the body. And when we do include the body deeply, we end up listening to it, not just to the looking at the contours in the gym and trying to get our, you know, tummies flat and doing all that stuff. It's more like, what's it like inside?
Mm.
And when you do that, you won't just come across a lot of interesting visceral and somatic signs. You'll also meet yourself at different times, different ages in life, and you'll sense different places of holding that can be very subtle. Something that happened at one point, maybe just left some tiny residue in part of your neck or back of one of your calves. And when you tap into your body, you find the body has its own wisdom. It's not a verbal wisdom, but it is a wisdom. And if you listen to the body, there's such a, like when you watch a great athlete having a in the zone, it's such beauty. They're not just playing extra great basketball or running 100 meters and usually fast. There's something extra. Like they're operating as a totality,
they're
whole.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't be whole if we don't include our body. And that means not the body is not down there. For many of us, our body is down there. We think, oh, my feet are down there. So if your feet are down there, then where are you? And most people will say, well, I'm in my head. And yet when I say to someone, tell me who you are, and say those words to me loudly, often they'll point to their chest.
Mm.
As a sense, like, I'm not really this brain. It's more like the heart is the core of my being, not just the physical heart, but the energetic heart.
And what are some of the practices or tips we can do if we want to recreate our relationship with our body? We may begin to notice that, wow, I don't really spend a lot of time checking in. What are some ways that you can recreate that relationship?
Well, one very quick way is to just throughout the day, just notice how your belly is. Like, and just say to yourself, soft belly, let your belly go, relax the belly. Because most of us hold our stomachs in a little bit because we, you know, we associate that with being more attractive. So it's important to stand tall, but let the belly just round and soften. And if we do that, that will bring more awareness to our center of gravity. It also brings more awareness to breathing.
Mm.
See, breath isn't easy. We're always breathing. So you focus on your breathing. Excuse me. you'll get more embodied.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're focusing not on breath, just the tip of the nose, like in some Vipassana systems, but you're actually aware of how does my belly move with my breath. And if you do it enough, you'll not just notice the belly rising and falling with the breath and the ribs and the chest. You'll notice, oh, the collarbones are moving. Then you go, oh, it's small, my back moves with each breath. And pretty soon you realize the entire body is being breathed. And then breathing becomes very pleasurable. I mean, a lot of people think, how boring to sit there and watch your breath. But if you watch it closely, to me, time disappears. And it's a beautiful thing because each breath is unique. And there's a little pause between the end of the exhale and the start of the next breath.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of subtleties to it. And I'm just talking about observing the breath doing itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's also ways what we can breathe in particular patterns. Like if you're at the gym and you're breathing consciously with the weights, you exhale as you're making the exertion, you can get very centered doing weights. Or I'm at the gym on an elliptical trainer. Maybe I'm counting my strides. I'm doing some sort of awareness practice for my torso. I get a really hard, beautiful aerobic workout, and I've also get to get very centered somatically while I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have a chance when we walk. Every time we walk, we have a chance to get more grounded. But a lot of us, when we're walking, we're not aware of our feet making contact in the ground and the swing of our hips and our legs. We're thinking, and we're lost in our thinking, and most of the thinking is not useful.
Right.
It's just random. It's noise.
Random, regurgitated, cycling,
yeah.
And often just creating more suffering inside of us.
Exactly. And the noisier the mind is, then you can't hear your intuitive voice speaking then.
So
and
true.
When you get more embodied, the mind gets quieter.
Mm-hmm.
I see a client get really embodied, and they've had some body work and emotional release, and they've realized some things. They sit up, and they're sitting there, and I can tell they're not thinking, but they're very present. Their mind is more like an empty, sentient space.
Mm-hmm.
And if a thought's needed, it's because it is truly needed. They need to go to the bathroom or something, or they want to ask me a question. But it's not random thoughts, like news reels running through their mind.
So excellent. And great
yeah.
little tips. And, of course, as soon as you said notice the belly, I'm like, oh, wow, my belly was actually held tight just right then.
How does it feel when you let it go?
You know, nice. I mean, just, you know, much
yeah.
more relaxed. And even just as you're talking about breathing, it's like, you know, just being present with all the spaces you brought attention to.
Don't you feel your belly kind of just dropping down? When you do that, it kind of drops down.
Yeah, love that.
Settles. Becomes rounder. I often say, you know, the most beautiful round bellies we see are on babies and on iconic Buddhas.
Mm.
It's round and soft. And the opposite of someone who's trying to get that six-pack and is sucking the guts in because there's women walking past them at the gym. How sad.
Right,
but
right.
The reality is so external then, and the internal world of that person is probably pretty neglected.
Yeah, a lot of pain inside. Well, let's
yeah.
talk about also one of the chapters is really about blind compassion
yeah.
and being America's inner peace coach and all. I have to admit that that's a place where maybe I've gone into that mode myself. But how can we maybe talk a little bit about blind compassion, but how can we tell the difference between, you know, when we're really in an authentic place of compassion versus blind compassion? And I think I've
yeah.
had a sense of both.
Yes,
and they
sure.
look the same in the moment, but, well, you tell us how they're different.
Well, my first hit when you said that was if I'm in blind compassion with someone that I'm with and they're suffering and I'm with them, is that I'm not going to challenge them.
Mm.
Now, somebody's challenge is not called for anyways in real compassion, but in blind compassion, we do not challenge. Someone could be treating you badly, and you would make excuses for them. You cut them slack. Oh, he's just had a hard day, or she's, you know, whatever. We cut them too much slack,
mm-hmm.
and we make too much of a virtue out of being soft.
Mm-hmm.
And real compassion can sometimes be extremely tender and soft and gentle, but it also can be fierce. Like, in other words, there's a capacity for both. Sometimes out of compassion, we have to say no. There's such a thing as wrathful compassion. We have to say no in a way that can be heard. It may have to be fairly loud or intense. It's still compassion. And blind compassion, I mean, I use the word blind because it doesn't see. It doesn't really see the other. It's so focused on how I look.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be soft. I'll be caring. But if I was really caring, I would be willing to step into some people some of the time. And the fact that I'm not going to do that means I'm not really caring about them. I just don't want to rock the boat. And probably because when I was a kid, the expression of anger signaled danger, or the lack of love. So here I am as an adult. Now I can spiritualize my learned avoidance of anger.
Mm.
And, you know, blind compassion is, again, tricky, not to shame oneself for it, but to know what tendencies do I have toward that? When do I tend to give away my power to others who are suffering or on my case in some way? And what is my relationship to my capacity to say no? And see, all this, all we're talking about here is far more psychological than spiritual. And to really cut through spiritual bypassing, we have to embrace our psychological dimensions more. Otherwise, we could just go on being blindly compassionate, for example, doing mantras, meditative practices that allow us to stay very soft and very gentle all the time. Then we get stuck in kind of a terminal niceness.
But we're
trying so hard to be positive.
Right, and then when it's really, what's really called for is something more fierce, there's a big should that, you can't access that, that's wrong, that's bad, and that ends up creating more pain and suffering instead of just pulling that,
emotion
out of the tool bag.
What if that person really needed you to step into them strongly because they have some sort of addictive pattern, they're really ready to hear something strong, and you're being too soft, they're going to be enabled.
Right.
Inadvertently so, probably been enabled to keep doing the thing that's hurting them.
Right. Ouch, we don't want to do that.
No, that's why it's important to understand blind compassion really, really well. And then, because you'll see it in people. You'll see people acting out. And those that act out the most are the ones that are most afraid to get angry, usually, or don't want to challenge, or they think confrontation is something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
When the word actually means to be in front of. Confrontation can be a very loving thing. It doesn't have to be this harsh, ugly activity.
Well, and as we were talking about the different emotions and really every single form of spiritual bypassing, the solution is the same if there's a solution to be had, which is really to get intimate with each nook and cranny of the pattern of the emotion, whether it's blind compassion or, you know, getting intimate with our body, getting intimate with emotions, getting intimate in the moment of reactivity and sex and romance.
And that begins, simply put, with turning toward our pain.
Mm-hmm.
Noticing we're in pain, not turning the pain into suffering, which means not dramatizing it, but just pain is pain. It comes with life. Turning toward it. It can be a tiny, tiny baby step. But it's such an important step when we turn toward our pain instead of trying to distract ourselves from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the metaphor would be, if you want the treasure, you got to face the dragon. You got to get past the dragon. You can't bribe or seduce the dragon. You have to face it fully. And to do that, you do it step by conscious step. Then when you reach the treasure, you realize that the encounter with the dragon has matured you enough to make good use of the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we're stepping toward the pain. It sounds so simple, but it's a huge step. It's a huge step for any of us.
Mm.
Once you do that, life looks very different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're still being afraid. You're still going to be angry. You still get hurt. All the same things will arise, but you'll handle them differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I see where we're approaching the top of the hour. So funny, because I was going to ask you about why boundaries make freedom possible, as we are coming up against a boundary. But I also wanted to have you speak to some things that you've got. I know you were going to do something special for our list with one of your e-books, and I know there's also a retreat coming up, I'm assuming up in Oregon.
Yes, we've moved to Ashland, Oregon, which is our home now, which is a lovely, lovely place, and we're doing all our work here now. So instead of traveling like we had before, which got very hard on us after all health-wise, we're just staying in Ashland. We're having people fly in, we're out of town, to do 2 or 3 day intensives with us, where we do maybe 4 or 5 hours of very deep psychotherapy and body work, spiritual practices. We usually find that's enough for most people, and that's for couples and individuals. And we're doing only one group this year. I used to do maybe 20, 30 groups in a year. This is one group. It's a one-week group in Ashton for only 14 people. I've learned over the years to make my groups small so everyone gets plenty of attention.
Wow.
So we're doing that. We're doing that. I think it's the end of July. And the gift, that's interesting. I thought, what gift? And I realize now it makes such sense. I have an e-book called Deepening Emotional Literacy, which everyone that registers for this call can get for half price.
Beautiful, beautiful. And we'll include that link so that where that you can they can access that and take advantage of that 50% discount. We'll include that tomorrow. So deepening emotional literacy, it sounds, I'm going to be picking that up and reading that as well. And if people want to register for your retreat, what's the best website for us to send people to?
Robert, best thing is to contact me, info@robertmasters.com.
Okay, info@robertmasters.com.
Yes, and they also can find out about it by going to our online work, which we do quite a bit of, teleconferences and online courses, and that's called mastercenter.net.
Mastercenter.net.
Yes, center.net. Now, that's where we're doing more because there's people who just cannot afford to come see us, say, who are in Europe, so we're doing more and more work online with courses. I'm also doing phone sessions more than I used to. I enjoy them. A half an hour to an hour with someone, covering a lot of territory, and then usually they end up coming to Ashland a few months later to do a face-to-face work.
Mm.
So we're so happy just to be in one place now. We just moved from Canada. Ashland is home, and the gypsy in me feels kind of retired. I just enjoy being in one place.
For now, we'll see what the future offers, right?
Well, we might be heading to California. That's probably the only other place we'll be working for a while. Is different parts of California.
Oh, great! Well, come on down. I'm here in Southern California.
Are you?
Yeah. But I just really I love the work that you're up to, and it's just so refreshing and I'm just so grateful. I mean, words don't quite sum up just, you know, my appreciation for your work that you're...
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I can see you're really making shifts in people.
And I also want to say I appreciate our conversation. This is not just me holding forth. This feels like a really good conversation. Obviously, we could have gone on a lot longer, but I understand we have time constraints.
Yeah, I know. We could, well, yeah, I'd love to, we could talk for another hour, and I imagine our listeners would love that, too.
Well, maybe another time you could have Diane and me on at the same time. We could just do a thing specifically on relationship.
You know, that would be great. I would love to do that.
That's our deepest passion. We love doing relationship work, especially with couples, so we would be very easy guests for that.
I would love to have you back, and I had so much fun promoting for this call, mostly because I just believe so firmly in this work and how important it is, and because ultimately it is about liberating ourselves and easing the pain and the suffering, and
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it we don't realize we're doing. So
mm-hmm.
thanks for pointing out some of these little patterns we're doing that maybe we thought were so good for us and not so much.
Yeah.
Fabulous. So again, we'll send an email out, give people links, and I'm going to just open up the line so people that are on the line can thank you themselves. Got the lines open if you want to say thank you.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Fabulous.
Thank you for being on.
Thank you, Robert.
Hi.
Thank you so much, Robert. We'll have you back, and we'll see you on the next call.
See you next time.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.